everyone, welcome back to another gaming podcast. This is a little different here. We're doing an interview, and you know what? What better way to start an interview? Our very first interview segment here with a Canadian icon over here, Victor Lucas from Electric Playground. Victor, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on another podcast, gaming podcast. This is awesome.
Super excited to have you. We'll hope to have you on our actual like gaming podcast, like weekly episode that we have with our other friends as well. I'm sure you know many of them as well. But we this one's a special occasion. I had to have you on here because something special is going on here. And I made sure to write it down properly here so I didn't miss any proper details or anything. But, you know, Electric Playground, let's go back in time, a little like, you know, a little like flashback and everything. So Electric Playground started way back in on a website in 1995. Believe it or not, websites were around. Like, you're probably one of the very first few thousands of websites, at least probably like let's say in Canada the first 10 let's be honest here back in 1995, and then it became into a show in 1997. For me, I remember watching it on City TV here in Toronto, you know, on a weekly basis here, on like at least on a Saturday, and then like right after that it came right after like that fashion show. I can't remember the TV show that came on right after that, but I was like, it's the fashion show that and Victor Lucas is right after that. So, like, you know, they made you dress up and then to watch Electric Playground run after that and everything. but then you slowly became into a daily show as well, which was even better because, right, as soon as you came home from school, you know what, like, you drop your school bags and, like, just see, like, a trail of, like, jackets, snow pants sometimes and everything to watch.
Your parents love that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm a parent now, and I know how much we love that.
Well, at that time, my mom didn't make it home, so I had, like, a little spare time. So when the show was over, I'm like, okay, let me clean it up and everything, you know? And you had different series of shows because you also had, like, Electric Playground, and with your review section, that slowly became its own show as well. And then there's also Judgment Day as well and everything. And then slowly, over time, you know, definitely branched off from Canada to the States, even parts of Europe, I assume, as well. But then a new beginning started in 2016 with YouTube. And now a new chapter in your life is starting this Friday, 2024.
That's March, a good way to frame it.
Right? March 24, because, you know, I see these as chapters because you never know what's going to lead you to or what you can branch off to and everything. Now everything these days is multiverse, you know, like multiverse. Exactly. Like, we don't know which branch tree we're going and everything. So, and where fans get to relive every moment starting March 23rd, every Saturday and every Saturday after that. With you, the creator of Electric Playground, how excited are you for this?
I'm incredibly excited. And for anybody that's been watching EP for a while, there's not going to be like rerun city because there were seasons where we had 13 episodes and then they would rerun and rerun and rerun and then we make another 13. We're just going to keep rolling. So we're going to do a fresh classic episode every single week, and we're going to premiere them and on YouTube. So the way YouTube premieres work is that you can chat live as they're happening. And so I'm intending to be there for as many of them as I possibly can. Definitely going to be there on March 23rd. And I might have some special guests here and there, might create some other content that kind of pairs up nicely with the classic shows. But last year where we met in person, I don't know if it was the first time, but we met in person. We discussed a little bit of what might happen with this stuff was at the University of Toronto, Mississauga.
Yes.
We partnered with them to digitize all of this content. They're sharing this material with an educational license with their students. And then they're giving me the material to use because, you know, we still own the rights to everything. So we're going to share it. And I felt like this was the perfect time. It's been a long, long journey. And you're right. When we started on the web, there were no backgrounds. There was no background colors. So it was all gray. And we had these really just simple little, you know, GIF images to kind of represent the sort of chapter headings of our website back then.
You didn't have like the trail mouse or anything like that, did you? Can I remember like that was like the whole, that was like the cool thing back in the day. And, or you could change the icon of your mouse and everything.
No, we didn't do that. We kept it pretty clean. We went to a black background with some little animated GIFs and stuff like that. I remember working on some of those things. I actually made the I personally HTML programmed and made all the images for the ASC Games website one year because we were sort of getting integrated in the video game industry. And it was a really amazing time back then in the mid-90s because the industry was big, but it was very open and it was very easy to make connections and make friendships across the whole business quickly. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we did. You know, we started out of Vancouver with not a history in television production or even a full integration in the video game industry. We just sort of knocked on doors and sent faxes and went and visited places. And it started with visiting broadcasters and sort of getting an interest in this concept and then rolling an interest in this concept with the game developers that we had reached out to. David Perry was a huge supporter right from the very beginning. He was in all of our pitch documents and stuff saying he's the founder of Shiny Entertainment. He would say, come on down and visit us and we'll talk about Earthworm Jim and everything else that we're working on. And it was awesome to have support like that. Jeff Keighley was actually in our pitch document. He was writing articles in Toronto. And we sent him an early demo of what we were thinking of for the concept. And he wrote us a nice letter and stuff. And I think I probably met him at E3 1995, the very first E3. I think I did. I can't recall that meeting, but I've known him forever. You know, and then
eventually he was on a couple episodes as well. Yeah.
Well, he was a co-host. He was on for a nice chunk, and I was reviewing games with him. And then G4 liked him and courted him, and he was based in L.A. And so they brought him aboard for first G4TV.com. And he started a great television career and now an award show career and an event career. Yeah. Very proud of that guy. Very passionate dude. I've been just so fortunate to work with these incredible people all the way along. You know, I've been able to kind of let them know that this was built from passion and love and a respect for this industry. And I'd reach out and sometimes I'd have to coerce them. Like Jade Raymond was not like super hot on the idea of being on television right at the beginning. But I was like, Jade, you know this business. You really know how to communicate around it. Yeah. You've already got this entrenched relationship with the people out there. You're going to be terrific on camera.
Yeah.
I saw her on stage at GDC one year. I'm like, who is that? She's amazing. She would be incredible on the show. And so I approached her after GDC and talked to her about it and brought her aboard with Julie Stoffer, who used to be on MTV's Real World show.
Yep.
We did a whole suite of auditions actually in Los Angeles for another correspondent, another host on the show. And she was amazing. She just brought so much innate curiosity. We did some mock interviews and stuff like that. She was fantastic. And so she came aboard. Marissa Roberto was kind of something of similar. Still,
yeah, I know Marissa for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, she was amazing when we first met. We met her at a fan expo or something like that. And she came up and she interviewed a bunch of the EP people that were on the team at the time. Mm-hmm. And she just really impressed me with her, her sort of do it by herself attitude or gumption, her ability to just have I think her boyfriend, who is now her husband, was there and just shooting. And she was just so confident and fun. And it was like, this is what we need. We need people that really know how to be self-motivated and be comfortable with people and have friendly conversations and have an articulated innate curiosity with the questions that they ask and have an intelligence about them and an empathy about them. And she was a terrific addition. And then some of the other guys were writers in the video game industry that I'd known at different events and stuff. Sean, I met through colleagues at in the game industry. We were growing into a daily show and we were looking for presenters and hosters and hosts. And I asked a few of my friends in PR in the video game industry in Canada, and they recommend this guy, Sean Hatton. He's just a tremendous personality and super nice guy, super friendly guy. And we had a meeting and I just loved that, you know, he's a literal drummer that beats to his own drum, you know, like he's a super unique individual and he was a great addition. And Steve and Raju, I've been so fortunate. And my wife, who has been there right from the very beginning, you know, tamping my crazy vision and my dreams, but also helping me in every conceivable possible way to facilitate everything and to support everyone. And she really helped run the company and take care of everybody. And awesome. it is a surreal time, Marcel.
That's crazy, man.
It's surreal because it's like I'm not just reflecting on a TV show that was kind of there. It's like that was my life, and all of these people are my friends, and we built so many things together. And It's going to be weird to, it's going to be like airing my home movies in a way, you know, with people and watching them with friends, or, you know, friends and viewers and stuff like that. But so excited as hell that this is finally happening.
Believe it, like, that's actually one of my follow-up questions, because I was going to ask you, like, I was going to ask you two questions, because I got so excited that this is actually happening, because you are, I'm sure many people have told you this now, that, like, you're a huge Canadian icon. Like, I see you as, like, Canadian heritage moment, you know, like no house hippo for Canada or anything like that, but like, you know, like you're like, there's like those Canadian heritage moments, they're like, oh, this first episode of Electric Playground, I'm like, yes, that is definitely a heritage moment, that's for sure, because you definitely up a lot of opportunities for not only for us Canadians from coast to coast, but even people down in like in the States, like who have, you know, like Danny or the Parises out there, maybe even like the Greg Millers out there as well, like they all know your show, and like in some way you've definitely had like inspired them to like, oh wow, if this guy could do it, like, or influence them in some way, like maybe I could do it myself in my own way, like maybe spit it my own way. So I definitely had to thank you for that. You definitely do deserve your kudos and your flowers for sure. But I wanted to know, like, well, first of all, how are you doing? And then and follow up, like, how does it feel to get this all done as well?
Well, it is a bit surreal. I've been having weird dreams lately, you know, I got to say, because it's like your whole life is in front of your face there, you know, like we're talking almost 30 years of reflection. And so I've been looking at some classic stuff, preparing little promo bits and things like that. And I've been doing quite a few interviews recently, a lot more than I normally do. I usually am just, you know, banging on the work that I do. Yeah. So I'm not usually in the seat where I'm being asked a bunch of questions. And you know, it is a lot of reflection, man. Like I have been so bloody blessed. I've been so lucky to work on so many cool things over the years. So it's energizing. It's certainly making me reflect a lot. I am aware of the amount of time. And I'm also acutely aware of how fortunate we were to be able to be in that position, and just how we didn't squander it either. Yeah. Like, we worked our butts off to build something kind of special, you know, and worthwhile and valuable. And I think that the secret of it was to visit these companies and to, you know, do this thing face to face, which was expensive. It took all the money that we made, basically, we spent it all. We spent all of it on going to visit everybody and making something that a university would find valuable. That was such a, I don't know, an underlining epiphanous moment for me. It's like, I don't know how much other work that's out there would be the drive for a school to go and let's collect all of this and put all of this manpower into digitize all of it. But because we made this conscious choice to go and visit these people and see these places and, you know, real-time document even these environments in these specific times, it made the content so vital. And we weren't aware of that. We were just doing it, you know? We were just doing it. My whole idea right from the beginning was like, let's go meet these people. Nobody knows who they are. We could have them in the studio. We could try to work out some kind of airline deal and fly everybody in. But God, there's a million shows like that. There weren't a lot of not just in games, but just in everything. There weren't a lot of shows that were endeavoring to get to these places. And that was the whole attraction for me. Like I was the kid in the 80s and 90s reading these magazines and infatuated with this business and these names that would populate and pop up every once in a while. Didn't know them, wanted to know who they were. They were in cities that sounded so attractive and enticing to me. Like I wanted to go, you know, and I wanted to go and see all of these things. And I figured if I wanted that, there was going to be a viewership out there that was feeling similar. You know, I wanted to go to the, you know, when we went to Atari in the early days and I talked with Dan Van Eldren and some of the other Atari staff, some of them had been there for, at that point, that was the mid 90s, but some of them had already been there for 30 years or 28 plus years or something like that. They had been there when the Atari 2600 was being made. And they told me about, you know, working with one or two people building a game, and then those same two people would go into the back into the factory, and they would assemble the cartridges together and put them in the boxes, and then you know, get them into bigger boxes to ship out everywhere. And like the building block kind of stuff about the video game industry was just so illuminating and fascinating, and you know, it was true passion,
definitely. Yeah, it was
true passion. And I'm meeting legends in the very first season. You know, there's me interviewing Shigeru Miyamoto for the first time. Yeah. And Nolan Bushnell pops up, the founder of Atari pops up in an early season. And, you know, I think Ed Boon and John Tobias in there. It just was surreal to, you know, we started at a run. We really did. And we were sort of in over our head because we hadn't really produced you know, a weekly series before.
Yeah,
but we started at a clip and we kept up with this crazy pace and we knew that the audience, even if they were completely in the dark, if we did it with honesty and with a sense of fun, and we got the business involved, and I would tell developers right from the beginning, like, this is for you, and if you guys don't like this show, then we failed in our mission, because we're making it for you guys, you know? And there was great response to that, you know? And, and because that was open to us, we learned a lot, and we were empowered by it. And then we came back for more, and we learned a little bit more the second season. But you mentioned going to daily in 2008. That was amazing that we got a chance to do that. We had done another deal with Rogers before that called The Lab with Leo Laporte, which was kind of a rebranding of Call for Help. And
I remember that show very much, actually. Like, I remember Amber MacArthur, and I know Callie Lewis, I think, she has a different name now, but they were here in Toronto filming it not too far from where I live, actually. And then they moved everything over to Vancouver with Leo Laporte and everything. So yeah, I definitely remember that.
Yeah, that was our production company putting that together, and got to work with Leo. And because we assembled a whole kind of studio system in there, like a live studio type deal, with a whole mixing board and, you know, prompters and all kinds of stuff, and, you know, microphones with like headsets and stuff like that, so we could talk to the control room and everything. That gave us a lot of discipline with, as a team, packaging that much material, because we think we made like 180 or 200 episodes of Lab with Leo Laporte. I think we only did it 1 year, though. Yeah, things changed at the end of the year.
Yeah, because
it didn't last that long.
It didn't last too long. I remember he would fly, because he had his own, like, he was starting the whole other trend, because this is when the whole podcast and everything was starting off. But he would fly from San Francisco, and then he'll fly back.
We gave Leo like a lot of eye-opening kind of wisdom on how to assemble all of that stuff. Yeah. Trust me, when he would come up, he was always looking in every room going, oh, this is how you guys did it. He went back to Petaluma and built a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And then he has This Week in Tech, and then they made his own branch off of that and everything. And I remember Revision 3 branched off of that as well. And then they got bought from Discovery, and I was hooked on that time during those days and everything. So that's for sure.
A lot of twists and turns, but that experience gave us the, I don't know, the foothold to be able to grapple with the technical kind of changes and challenges that going daily with Electric Playground was going to mean. But we still needed to be out in the field kind of program. So we had teams and satellite teams in different cities, in Toronto and Montreal and Los Angeles and San Francisco, and so we were visiting everywhere. But that was a very nerve-wracking time for me, because we were shifting from a weekly known entity, you know, where we had been building a series of seasons at that point. And we had grown, I think, to 50 weeks a year or something like that by that point. And we had the two weekly shows, but then suddenly we were launching a daily show. And we knew we had to expand out from just talking about games. It had to be a much more sort of full-on entertainment-focused show with the heart of games. And I didn't know how it would go, but it actually ended up becoming a much better show when it was on every day, because of the access points and the I don't know, the variety that we got, and the types of people that we had access to, and the types of pieces and things that we could put together, and also the growth of the team and everybody's new contributions and all that. But it was amazing, the two learn and be gifted these beautiful opportunities based on our work. You know, it wasn't just like, somebody doing us a favor. We were delivering really solid seasons and episodes every year, and people were liking that, and they liked working with us, and they kept hiring us and giving us green lights on things, or sponsoring the show and sponsoring it again. So I'm incredibly grateful to all of those businesses that have been there from the very beginning and have supported us as we've gone. But we also really learned a lot, and we really tackled a lot of things along the way. And I'm so unbelievably proud of our team, and just so freaking grateful it was those people that helped to build the Electric Playground. And what's going to be cool, I think, is to take a moment to celebrate that every week, you know, as we roll back into this. And I don't know what we're going to do when we get to the daily seasons and the two shot guy. I don't know. Like, one of the things that's been a bit nerve wracking about this whole proposition is that I don't want EP to just be about what we've done, because I still make lots of fresh material. I just talked with Jeff Minter about the making of the new Jeff Minter compilation that Digital Eclipse did. I've got an interview with the executive producer of X-Men 97 that I'm working on now. I've got two or three reviews that I'm going to have out this week. And I'm busy with this stuff all the time. I still live this, you know?
Absolutely.
But I think EP also exists as this heritage thing, or this
it's definitely a heritage moment
thing, for a lot of people.
I know many people are like, I've been watching since I was a kid and everything like that, but which is true and everything, but like, for me, I didn't want to put like an age or like, wow, you've been doing this for a long time type of thing, but like, no, like, this is like a great this is a great moment. Like, it's this should be definitely celebrated, because I'm sure you open like many eyes for, like I said, for Canadians coast to coast to like, wow, like, if you could do a show like this, then I could do my own show, like, on music or sci-fi, and you definitely have...
Absolutely.
Inspired. Like, I have, like, I'm sure there's not, like it would be hard to find someone who'd be like, oh, I never heard of Electric Playground. Maybe the new generation now, because not on TV anymore, but, like, there's a vast amount of people like, oh, I've heard of Electric Playground, or I've heard of Reviews on the Run, or maybe even Judgment Day. I remember watching it on G4 or City TV or... You know, many channels that, like, you know, because, like, I remember seeing on many different outlets as well. That was like another thing as well. So, like, sometimes daily will happen, then, like, you'll still see like a weekly, but it was like an episode from like years ago. Like, it was just like almost sporadic and everything. But that's just how like TV media goes and everything. They're like, oh, we have the tape.
The passive viewership that we used to have, and the family viewership that we used to have, is the stuff that I miss the most. You know, like, now it's so targeted and siloed and algorithmically served up to us, and I think it's done a real disservice to the video game industry, quite frankly. I think we're all watching stuff in echo chambers, and we're all struggling with discoverability, and we're seeing a lot of, you know, just vile stuff bubble up to become the thing that draws the most clicks and eyeballs, and And what's being forgotten is that there are human beings that make these things, and they work really hard, and they get out of bed every day with hope in their heart to try to entertain people.
Yep.
And we're just not having the discussions with those people. It's always attack. It's always, you know, you said this, you promised that, and this game doesn't have this and that, and then why is there a patch? And it's just like, just, you know, so much vitriol, so much venom about people working at big businesses, yes, that are trying to make a lot of money, yes, but invariably these companies then take that money and invest it in more things that they hope people will like. And yeah, we've got too many live service games, and yeah, we got too many things with, you know, microtransactions and with their hands out and all that stuff, but that isn't the totality of the video game marketplace. There's a lot of really good choice out there. There's a lot of great, really great work at all levels, AAA and indie, of course.
Yep.
And I don't know. There's just, I see a lot of people saying that the video game industry sucks now, and it used to be better then. And man, I've been here the whole way.
Yeah.
And the best games that are being made right now. There are some incredible stuff. Yes, there's some repetition. Yes, there's, sequels. Yes, there's problems. It's not perfect. But holy crap, you know, these really artistic, creative people have these this incredible technology at their disposal now, and they can realize dreams like never before. They can make things happen like they've never been able to before. We all want more. We all want the games industry to be, you know, responsive to the concerns that we have over digital loss. You know, like you have a license to play this and then it's revoked. Yes, we want the video game industry to figure that out. We want the video game industry to figure out preservation and serving up classic stuff. But God, there's so much fun material for us to play. And, you know, there's a lot to be said also for going back into backlogs and playing stuff that you might have missed from a year or two ago. There's just no shortage of really great news in video games.
Yeah.
And we spend so much bloody time on, and with great news also are great people, you know, really cool, creative, great human beings. Mm-hmm. And all of that is being buried in favor of, I don't know, what is it today? You guys know. It's exhausting. it's the hatred that flows around video games.
It is definitely exhausting, especially when people don't realize when a game was broken back in the day, that game was broken. Yeah. You had to wait for another release of that game. Like this, totally. There's a reason why we have so many Street Fighters, for example, because they were like, "Oh, let's patch this in and like give them a little extra. Maybe add in 4 more characters. Maybe add in the secret boss."
I was on another podcast. They made that exact same point, man. That's so funny.
It's crazy because that's right. We have so many Street Fighters. Everyone's like, "Oh, I love this version of Street Fighter." I'm like, you know, this game's broken for a reason, right? Like, this game, I used to remember doing like Hadoukens in the air. I'm like, that shouldn't be happening. I'm still in the air doing like 60 Hadoukens. Like, what's happening here? So
that's so funny.
We're definitely in a great time, and like, I just, you know, I feel like, and that's the thing, that the human element. I feel like people are just. Like it almost feels like a Christmas movie or like a Hallmark movie or something like that, where like if you forget like the whole human element, that one guy is trying to bring back like the human feeling or the Christmas spirit type of thing, like feeling like, oh, let's just bring it back. People are like, I don't have time for that, you know, like it's such like a rush like world we're in. And I'm like, just, you know, maybe go on the collector's lane and just kind of like, you know, take it in for a little bit and enjoy the ride for a little bit. And I feel like just people just forgetting that, which is kind of sad and everything. So,
I just watched a video on YouTube yesterday. It was a well-produced video and it was quite funny, but it was just all hate on Ubisoft for half an hour and people are evil there. And it's like, man, there have been some evil things that have been done and there are some crappy people for sure, but you're painting with a huge wide brush. People are showing up every day. Have you played Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown? You know,
did you play
the Crew Motorfest even?
Yeah,
you know, like I know we're all hating on live service and it does. I mean, live service is as stupid as a business idea. Yeah. You cannot have a whole bunch of them at the same time. It's the biggest, stupidest risk that video game companies could make because most of them are going to fail. So don't do them all at like that. You know, every once in a while, we're going to get Helldivers 2, but it's such a damn risk and the companies should just mix and match and all that stuff, especially with all the talent there. All that being said, the Crew Motorfest was incredible. It was massively fun.
New season's coming
enjoyable
out soon.
Experience.
I still play it now.
Yeah.
It's a great game and everything. You know,
Riders Republic was awesome as well, you know, and yeah. It's so easy to just hate on a whole thing because of one little thing, you know,
or absolutely.
One thing that bugs you. And then it's just a big pile on. And then people are just like, they're out with their pitchforks. And it's so sad, you know?
And it's sadly old for clicks as well. That's another thing as well. Like,
it'll
just be like.
Well, that always blows me away because I get some, you know, hate messages every once in a while on my reviews and stuff like that. I have to say the EPN community is pretty freaking incredible. A lot of them are lifers like me, and they're just amazing on the live streams and also on the YouTube vids that I put up. But, you know, every once in a while, for sure, I'm just gobsmacked by just like the infantile behavior of people on a YouTube comment. Like, I couldn't imagine waking up and writing something awful about somebody's work, you know, like the impetus to do that. It's like they've just been brought up so poorly or something, you know, like just to have so much time and energy to ball it up into that hate message and post something like that, you know, and mine aren't that bad. I know like there's a lot of stuff that's out there that's a lot worse, but it just makes you stop. It's like, what is up, man? Yeah. Like, why do, and I'm sure like anybody that would post on mine probably stops on five or six other things in a day and just posts awful things on other people's stuff.
They go and look for it. That's their job, apparently. It's a non-paying job, but that's their job and everything. It's like, I'm going to hate this post and everything.
It makes me it stops me cold. It's like, what the hell? Like, there's so many things you could do. So many things you could do with that energy.
Absolutely.
And make your life better than to sit down on, to stop and just spew like that. But, yeah, you know,
I assume you didn't have something like that back in the day when before all this happened. Like there was no fan.
No,
like, there was no fans writing in angry letters like, how do you give a 6 out of 5 to like my favorite game?
That's fine. That's totally fine. That's like opening for discourse. But like, if I've had things where I've made a comment or a review on something and it doesn't happen that often. So I don't want to even just prop this up as like this is the norm. But they'll come on and it's just filled with hate. Like you suck at your job and you're terrible and you're a piece of shit, whatever, you know, it's just this diatribe. And it's like, God, because you like that game or you didn't like that thing and I liked it or you didn't like it, this is what you're going to. And so back in the day, it was never like that. It would be like, oh man, that was fun to watch, but I totally disagree with what you just said right there. Or how could you give this? I love this game.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yeah. Yes, totally. But to attack people, and I'm not even saying this really happens that much with me. I just see it and I go, Jesus, this is what a lot of people, like I couldn't imagine, because I don't get the massive views on tons and tons. Some go quite well, but you know, it's not every single one. It's because I cover everything. YouTube doesn't know what the hell to do with me. Yeah. But I can't imagine what some people must go through, and I just can't sync with the people that think like that. It just boggles my mind. Like, what a waste of life. Like, you have this gift with your life and you spend chunks of it on the internet just throwing grenades at people's joy. Like, that's what you want to do with your life? What a terrible way to exist, you know?
It's wild. It's absolutely wild. So I've actually been wondering, how was your transition into YouTube from TV media to now YouTube media? How did that transition go for you? And I'm sure
I'm so nervous.
Trying to figure out as well, right? So
I was so freaking nervous. I was like, not because of any of that, just because I was basically, I had to lay off a lot of people as the show wound down in 2015, and we just didn't have the operating budgets, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I was really at a crossroads, and I knew it conceptually how unique our position was to be in sort of mainstream media and to have a television show and have a budget where a lot of people could actually be, you know, gainfully employed. And I didn't really quite understand how much content was being made out there by solo people. And people just going out to events and just shooting everything and cutting everything and putting stuff up on their own. And I had some awareness of what YouTubers and stuff like that were doing, but also a lot of media outlets and things like that were kind of being operated that way. Mm-hmm. And so it was a big kind of mental shift for me. But Ubisoft invited me to the Division One event San Francisco in 2016 in January. So it was like right at the beginning of the year. And so we were wrapping up with EP on television, and it was very emotional. Like, we'd had a huge long run, 25 seasons of Electric Playground and 14 seasons of Reviews on the Run. And we'd done all of this work, and then we were kind of pivoting, and I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. I didn't know if I was going to go and find another job or do a different kind of path, but I loved what I was doing. And so Ubisoft invited me to this thing, and I said, yeah, I'd love to go. You know, I'm friends with lots of people and I've covered their stuff for years. So I went to this thing and I just took my iPhone and I shot a video with a light and microphone plugged in and all that stuff. So it looked like the TV show as best as an iPhone could kind of could kind of muster.
Yeah.
And then I went home and edited the thing together, and I posted it on our YouTube channel, which we really hadn't been able to focus on because our broadcast license deals had really been about TV first. It had to be about TV. And sometimes we had like a 7-day delay on when we could post to the internet and stuff like that. It wasn't really thought of that way. Yeah. We were all trying to move to that direction, but okay. We were also working with companies that had some pretty understandably strict guidelines around all of that stuff. Everything is totally different in the media landscape now, but
yeah.
So anyways, in 2016, my first kind of video up was a preview of The Division, interviewing some of the developers and talking about some of the hands-on moments that I had with it. And it did pretty good. I posted it up and people were watching it and commenting on it and got quoted around the internet a little bit. And I'm like, Jesus, I just put all of that stuff together myself. I guess I could continue doing that. And that was kind of the door opening on that. And then of course, the whole time, the whole way through, I've been, chatting about partnerships and other kinds of things, and took a long time to kind of find the right partnership with the University of Toronto, Mississauga, with the value that they saw in our content, but also to digitize it and to work out an idea of what to do with that. And then I've been, working on external projects like doing some hosting stuff with Nintendo working a lot with the Vancouver Film School. And so I've just been keeping busy, just been working on lots of little things. We did documentaries and then the pandemic happened and yes. I had to kind of shrink again and bring everything into the basement here. But then there's been technologies like this that have allowed me to stay connected and have lots of interesting interviews and do all kinds of stuff. A little bit less of the location stuff, although I have gone to some events and some things out there. For the most part, my job has been the same almost all the way through. And I think what I'm going to be showing the world is what EP can be with these classic pieces, what EP can be with a budget and with allowing us to kind of grow a little bit and scale up with to find a team of incredible people out there. And yeah. I'm hoping that becomes an eye-opening thing for the video game business and the media business a little bit. And who knows what happens.
I'm excited. I'm definitely excited because this is the best way, even because this is why people always say to like, oh, post your work online, post it on LinkedIn, especially LinkedIn as well. LinkedIn's like the best way to like, show off your work. And people are like, oh, I didn't realize you did that. Maybe I can use this for this job. And you have like 25 years of a great resume for sure. 25 plus years for sure of a great resume with EP and all your shows. Do you have like a special episode you're looking forward to? You're like, oh, I can't wait for this episode to come up to talk to discuss about. You don't want to spoil it, which I understand.
The first one's pretty cool. The one that we're running this Saturday is a pretty cool one because it's collecting a lot of the pieces that we shot at E3 because it didn't air until 97, but we started shooting at the very first E3 in 1995 with a Betacam SP. And so we've got some good looking clips and footage from the very first E3 and the 96 E3 and the 97 E3. We focus a lot on early days of E3 in that episode. But to be honest, every episode, I think, it's all reflective of your tastes and what you're kind of wanting to get out of that era and out of the games that you're interested in, all that stuff. So it's going to be a different thing for everyone. Mm-hmm. Obviously for me, every one of the shows is pretty darn special to reflect on and look back on. And I think we added a lot of entertainment into every single episode. And as the shows were received and we started to get feedback and the video game community started to see that stuff, we got a little crazier, a little sillier, a little bit more ambitious. And, we'd visit LucasArts and lightsabers would come out in the middle of an interview and stuff like that. And it's going to be, I think, really fun to just sort of chart our progression and to chart our confidence, basically, at building all of this stuff. But, it's going to be rad to see a lot of familiar faces and friends that I maintain, that I still am connected with. And in fact, I will have a nice little surprise going up after the first episode this week.
Cannot wait for
that. Which I think is going to be pretty cool. I got a busy week, but it's going to be... it's gonna
this,
be fun.
This is your and then it's this gonna is your be tour fun week. To... You know, like you're going on different like late night shows, talking about the show. Like, oh, I have a great movie coming out right now. You know, like let's check out the clip right now. You know,
it is different to be interviewed, though, man. It is a different thing to be on the other side of it. You know, but it's really nice that people. That people care about what we've done and, you know, that want to extend that invite and have me on their shows and stuff. It's really cool.
Yeah.
I had no idea the ripple effect of what we were doing, you know, like, and back then it wasn't like we weren't charting views and ratings. And I mean, we had to some degree to kind of keep going. But it wasn't like today where that's your whole identity, you know, like your subs and your view count and everything and how many likes and hearts. And we're all so infected with that disease right now. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the, you know, we were honored with the opportunity and we didn't want to screw it up. And we did our best to just make something that we had fun with and that we hope people would like. And it was a good way to live, you know? And then I remember when we went on G4 in America for the first time, and I got to be really good friends with the vice president there, who was kind of head of working with acquisitions and stuff. Really wonderful guy. And he talked to us. He is a wonderful guy. Still, I don't want to talk about it in past tense. Yeah, but he mentioned something really profound, because during our time there, of course, the G4, as we had signed up with, was merging with Tech TV to become this one giant ship. And he was very nervous about it, because his history was at running and being there at the birth of MTV in the States. And he recognized the new dilemmas that the network was going to face as it was getting raided. Suddenly, you know, the pressure was really on. The pressure was on with bringing in advertising and bringing in subscribers when G4 launched. But when G4 and Tech TV merged, the pressure was really high, because they were in X number of million homes, and they were suddenly being compared to every other outlet out there at that scale. And they had to hit numbers on their shows that correlated with the advertising asks that they had. And a lot of the ad buyers and things like that didn't really care about content at all. They were just looking at eyeballs. That's it. But they just wanted that numerical thing. And that was going to bring unbelievable pressure on everybody at the network. And that's exactly what happened. You know, it became a real pressure cooker there. And so that was a big eye-opening thing. And we were fortunate enough to make our stuff kind of free of that pressure. We were just this independent outfit out of Vancouver. Everybody gave us a lot of leeway and a lot of autonomy, a lot of respect and trust that we knew what we were doing. We learned a lot of things. We got great feedback a lot of along the way from our collaborators and our partners. Often kind of to slow down a little bit, because we'd already kind of picked up all of the language and we built this relationship with our existing viewership, but we were growing every year and we were building into new homes and with new viewers that maybe didn't know all of the stuff that we were talking about. And so often it would be like, this is fun and fast, but maybe slow down just a little bit, let people in, because they're not going to really know all of the ins and outs of this developer that you're talking with. And so we built specific content to appreciate that and respect that. And you know, when you have a run like that, you have a lot of time to evolve it. Obviously, and a lot of time to kind of analyze it and post-mortem it and think of what was working and how to shift it and how to make it work more. And even when we launched as a daily show, we had months of working it out. And then we shot a bunch of sample shows and worked with Rogers to kind of get their take and their feedback on stuff. And you know, all of that helped. You know, and I don't know if we ever made the perfect show, but I think over the course of all of that effort and that real concentration to respect our audience and respect our studio partners, like all the mm-hmm. companies that we were visiting, and our broadcast partners, you know, everyone. Yeah. We didn't want to let anybody down, you know?
Well, like, even if you're still contemplating, if you think you didn't do the perfect show, you had an amazing show, because to be on for 25 years, That is not, like, there's only a few, like, shows who have out there, like, besides, what, The Simpsons, I guess, for example. Like, it's only, like, there's only a few number of people who have been, like, oh, yeah, we've been on for 25, 20, even 20 years plus, even, like, make the first season, for example.
Yeah.
So you definitely had an amazing show, that's for sure. And, like, especially with the whole G4, like, I found that whole era of G4, yeah, there was, like, Attack of the Show, X-Play, and then, like then you guys would come right on right after that. And I found you were also, like, the perfect fit for that, because those two shows, they had, like, their own creativity, and, like, hey, just do whatever you want, figure it out. Have your own creativity to spin, and you guys kind of fit right in right the same way as well, because you had your own creativity and like you mentioned, leeway as well. So you were definitely, like, the perfect, like, fit, time slot fit right in right after that, because, like, you had those two shows, and then, like, you guys came on right after that. And it was just, like, it just blended in right perfectly, and, like, I can't, you know, even up to now, I still miss those days, and I'm sure you do as well, because it was just, I feel like you guys were honoring, like, something, like, a culture that meant not to me, like, back then. Like, now it's, like, everyone loves, like, the nerd culture now, of course, you know. But, like, back then, it wasn't as cool, or, you know, you kind of, like, you didn't really tell everybody about it. Like, you had a small little group of friends at the corner of the lunch table. And they're like, oh, yeah, I'm reading this comic book right now and everything. And you guys brought it out and made it, you know, started the leeway and started the whole trail of making it cool and making it more, like, I guess, the norm now these days. Now, like, oh, everyone loves it now. Like, now, like, people are, like, telling me, like, oh, you want to go to Fan Expo? I'm like, I've been trying to get you to go to Fan Expo for years. Now you want to go to Fan Expo? They're like, I'm busy this weekend. Sorry. Like, you know, just like, but, like, it's wild now to see, like, how everything kind of shift over and became more modern.
Like, well, Fan Expo now, so. and things like Comic-Con are, like, they're perfect examples of collecting a massive amount of people to come and enjoy a singular thing. And I think what's happened is we don't really have that too much with media now. I think we have so many voices, and so, which isn't terrible. It's just the way it is. But I find that, you know, I think the best thing that we offered was just a 30-minute condensed take on all of the stuff that was happening. Our tag at the time was Everything Cool Every Single Day. And I think what exists as nerd media culture or media around nerd culture now is kind of exhausting. It's so much, you know, and it's so much time. And I think a lot of things are slipping through the cracks because people are busy in one direction or whatever, you know, where they it's just siloed, and it feels like a bit of a reversion to me in some ways, because when I pitched EP, it was about let's lift off from magazine culture, and prior to that it was fanzine culture, where people were just getting together and building, you know, documentation about stuff that they were passionate about for that circle. And I feel like there's so much of that out there right now. Certainly there's things like, it's hard to even quantify what the hell mass market is or what brings people together. But you still see things like Entertainment Tonight. You still see things like Extra and TMZ and stuff like that. And they will focus on this culture every once in a while. And it's weird for me, I was a big magazine nerd. I used to really enjoy magazines, starting with the video game magazines. But then I got into lots of other stuff too, Rolling Stone and Spin and Esquire and lots of stuff. And it's been weird for me to see Esquire focus attention on games, or Vanity Fair focus attention on video games. But I don't know. I still feel like there's an absence of what we did out there, you know. Absolutely. And I feel like there's still room for it, you know. I don't know how or where, but it boggles my mind that there isn't something more out there dedicated to this world, but in a really accessible, digestible way. Because I think you have to be a power nerd and have time on your hands, which is it's already like you're whittling down and you're whittling down and you're whittling down. And then they're going off in their whole different directions to find out what they want to find out about, you know? Maybe that's the way it is. Maybe we're all just scrolling through 1 minute videos now, and that's how we learn.
Man, I had the whole algorithm, 1 minute long form, one day, the short form, the other day. It's a headache. I don't know what it wants. Like at end of the day, I'm just gonna put out what I am very passionate about.
And hey, that's
I'm
sure all you can do.
And just let it see if it floats and everything. I also wanted to bring a little Canadian element to our conversation here, actually, because we're you and I, we're very fortunate enough to like for example, I'm going to PAX East in the next couple of days. And like I know some people go to GDC. I believe you've been to GDC before many times.
I specifically, I was supposed to go this and I would have been great, but I've got a lot on my plate right now. So I just said, no, let's not go this year, but I really want to go.
You're on tour right now. You know,
I'm kind of on tour. Yeah. It's a weird time right now.
Yeah. So like, what do you think Canada has to do to like level up like the gaming media here?
Would you love
to see more conventions? Like, I know we have the Canadian Game Awards, but like, I would love to see it like televised in a way. But what are your thoughts on that?
Hats off to you and this grouping of individuals that I see on a perpetual basis here, like the Another Gaming Podcast and Console Creatures and stuff like that. I'm starting to see a lot more of you guys work together and band together, and I think that is absolutely the right thing to do. I think that there's a real opportunity to dive into the existing development scene and prop them up and let people know who these people are in Canada. I think that, you know, if you're in Canadian media and your focus is on, you know, a Canadian element in your storytelling, you have to take every effort you can to kind of shine the spotlight on Canadian devs. You know, I think one of the most exciting developers over the last little while has been Max Inferno. This partnership team that built an indie game for the very first time, that found a niche out of Nova Scotia. Just a fantastic story, you know. And they had great publishing partners, and they had great exposure. They had a great video kind of reveal about A Little to the Left and about who they were as people. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful story. And I know that there are many, many more out there. The gentleman who built Tunic, I think, is a wonderful story as well. And I, you know, some people want to live in anonymity as well. I think that's part of the Canadian identity. You know, like, we really don't love to bang the drum for ourselves. And I'm kind of the same. I know I'm in the media and it feels weird. It just feels weird. Like, we're raised to not think like that, you know? Yeah. But I feel like it's incumbent on Canadian media, if their focus is on the Canadian game scene and building that up, is to do as much name dropping as possible around these companies, you know, build as much content so that these names become prominent in people's lives. Because right now, so many Canadian developers are working in obscurity. So many game developers, period, but especially Canadian developers. And part of it is the sublimated ego that Canadians have. Like, they don't want to project, you know, that they're super special. And there's also a hugely collaborative element in video games. And sometimes when you raise your hand to take the attention, it can create some friction within game teams and stuff like that. And that can be, incredibly damaging in certain ways. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be a bit of respect there. But I think it's really important for Canadian writers and Canadian game media to do what they can to kind of draw attention to these different firms and these different individuals. And what's happening increasingly in the AAA space is that a lot of Canadian divisions of these huge conglomerates are co-devs. They're part of the development idea, you know, strategy, or the full makeup of a huge game. And that should be called out as well. Even if the studios themselves, even if these huge publishing giants don't do enough about that, I think it's important for Canadian focused media around this space to bang the drum about that. You know, I interviewed the and that is an EP's, you know, natural space. I know we are a Canadian media brand, but it's not like, you know, we've been privileged to be talking with people all over the place, and that's been our MO from the very beginning. But I certainly feel that call to highlight Canadian game makers. I created the, you know, the original version of the Canadian Video Game Awards solely based on that. And I know it's trickier, you know, and I know that the ability to pay the bills on building that content is trickier, you know. Media in general is a lot trickier than it ever has been. And so maybe work like that has to be really done in partnership with the game development community at large, but I think it will benefit the industry. I think any discussion around the you know, this innate drive to build this creative content is going to furnish more people wanting to join that drive, you know? Yeah. And I feel like we have done such a disservice to that with a lot of the storytelling around video game development. And there's been such a clenched attitude about access and when we can talk about this and who can say this and hi, you know, and what they say. And then on the flip of it is a lot of angry people attacking developers and all of that stuff. And so we have really, you know, dampened our ability to just hear from these human beings and have them inspire future human beings to want to make games, especially at the AAA sort of caliber, you know, in these bigger studios and stuff. All we hear is how threatening these companies can be and how poorly they're managed. I mean, that's all we hear, you know, and none of them are perfect, but
then which company is?
There's still no company is. And there's different stresses at a smaller level, you know. Maybe they're, you know, people's feelings are taken into consideration a little bit more if you're a smaller business, and that's great, but you know, you still got to pay the rent, you know. You still got to meet payroll. I mean, it still can be incredibly frustrating at every level. But if that's what the focus is, then that's not very inspiring, especially if the flip on that is, you know, hate YouTubers making millions of dollars a year and people going, well, I don't want to do that hard work with this thing where I might get laid off or whatever, because that business has got to, they were in the news for being crappy for 2 years, so they must be crappy forever. I want to go make YouTube, or I want to be a Twitch streamer because that's going to be a great career choice for me forever. It's like, well, you know, I feel like if the whole world does that, what are we going to stream? Yeah. Are we all just gonna be, you know, streaming games from 20 years ago? Because, like, you know, we need people to be inspired to want to go and make the next thing. And absolutely. And some of them are gonna take really big teams, you know. So, and that's certainly a quandary for the business to figure out right now. But you know, takes a collaborative group of ideas to build things that really shake this industry up. You know, it isn't absolutely. Just a. There aren't too many tiny little teams that I don't know, take us huge steps forward.
Yeah.
There absolutely. Are great ideas that come from tiny little teams. I don't mean to diminish that, but it does. Generally, I will say that the large studios that are resourced and financed and there's just a tremendous amount of creative effort collaboratively applied, that tends to rock our business, you know. And you can point directly at things like Alan Wake 2, and next year it will be Grand Theft Auto 6, and you know, I mean, I don't have to list out, you know the games that are out there.
There's too many right now. There's too many.
there are too many.
Out of curiosity, I know it's only March and everything, but do you have a game of the year front runner as of right now? Like, what, like, so far that's like, okay, you're gonna be on the list right now?
I think it's got to be Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. I think that it's it's beautiful. I think it's much better than Remake. I just played through Remake again before I played Rebirth, and it's not perfect again, but it's just so nostalgic and beautiful and fun and clever, and the you know, this mini game overload, and It just hits on a lot of wonderful cylinders. The music is incredible.
Yeah.
I absolutely adored that. And I adored Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown as well. And Tekken 8 was incredible. I mean, those are the things that immediately pop up for me. But we've started off 2024 at a really, really high level.
Absolutely. I got to give more love to Prince of Persia because that's for me, like my first nominee ballot right there. Is Prince of Persia.
It's incredible.
I had such a great time with that game. Tekken 8.
What'd you play it on?
I played it on PC, actually.
PC.
But I know you loved it on the Switch, because I saw your Contra review, and like you were hoping that they kind of ran like how Prince of Persia did, but then, you know, maybe, I know it's way forwards, like, you know, like you mentioned in your review and everything, which everyone should go check it out, by the way. It's available right now. By the way, check it out.
Yeah.
But it's, they definitely, you. They definitely, like, that one, it just blew me away. The art style, the character, like even the story alone was really cool, and like just like the character juggles you could do like with that game, like if you were especially come from like a fighting game background, like I'm not a strong fighting game background, but I understand how to do the moves and everything, and like you could literally juggle enemies up in the air, and the parry was perfect and everything, and I also had a chance to talk to the producer as well, and like we had a blast talking, like he almost missed his flight. We kept on talking for a little too long and everything, and like that's another thing you were talking about, the whole like passion and human element. Like it shows with that game, and like I didn't want to put that game down. I was actually sad I was coming to the end. I was like, oh, let me go see if I can find something else or try to get like all like the shards and everything. So
they've got DLC coming. Yeah. So
That's a lovely surprise. Yeah. You got me with a little exclusive surprise here. That's nice.
Yeah, they have a bunch of DLC coming, and they've got a permadeath mode that's coming, and all kinds of other things to bring us back in, and hopefully it continues. I think it's a real mistake that it wasn't on Steam. I really think you'd be screwed that up. That is a perfect Steam Deck game. Nobody wants to jump through these bullshit hoops anymore.
Oh, I know.
You know, put something on that's on the Epic Store onto the Steam Deck, just like. Yeah. Make that happen. Steam Deck should be just the de facto kind of base point for anybody publishing on PC. I've got a great Steam Deck anecdote as well, actually. Yeah. At PAX last year, I went to an indie night thing, and I went and took a look at some really cool games, but everywhere I looked at almost, I'd say 85% of the stations, there were lots on monitors and things like that, but at 85%, it was developers showing off their games running on a Steam Deck, all of these indie games. And I'd never seen that before. I'd never seen this uniformity in PC game development or indie game development, a device so perfectly positioned to show off indie game development creativity. And of course it makes so much sense. If you're traveling to an event somewhere to show it off, and I don't know about you, but my play pattern has really changed with the Deck, and you know, I've always been a huge fan of the Nintendo Switch, but Portal launched last year.
I'm glad you mentioned the Switch, because there was one year at a convention, they had like a lot of developers were focusing on the Switch, not due to the so many vast amount of Switches out there, but there was one convention where they lost power, and Sony and Xbox, they could have showed their demos, but the only ones who were running was the Switch. They're like, oh, just pick it up and play the game and everything. So I mean, it makes sense with the Steam Deck and everything. So it will be cool that this is from our friend of mine who's part of the podcast, Riley. He mentioned what would you think, like would you buy a system that came with Steam on like integrated as well? I'm like, that will be like, that'll be mind-boggling, like if Xbox had Steam built in it, that would be I think that's just game
Xbox
over right
should
there.
Make a portable Xbox should absolutely make a portable, and PlayStation should make a PSP 2 100%. They should also allow you access to the PC so you could download stuff from their PC stores and the Steam store. That would be great. But I'm also like, we're about to get iPad M3s with OLED screens. We're about to get iPad Pros, which is a different price bracket, but the iPad, you know, is like it's a computer. And I have started to play some of the games on Mac, like Death Stranding, and some games already on Mac you can run on your phone at the same piece of software. It's you've got your Mac version, and you've got your phone version, and I think that sort of middle line, the phone's too small, like to run Resident Evil 4 or Death Stranding, because you're just looking at all of these little tiny details. But on the Mac, they've been running great, and I feel like Apple has an opportunity here with these M-powered iPads with a PlayStation DualSense controller paired up to them to make them really, really attractive, you know, portable video game systems that aren't necessarily laptops. They're not far away from the price of a laptop. That's the only thing. These iPads are not cheap. But there is something there. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, there's another category in the middle of all of this that could be really intriguing, especially if we're talking about flip-up devices and things like that. Apple's just got to get serious about their partnerships with game companies. Absolutely. And they got to spend some of their trillions on video games. Like, that's one of the things that I love the most about Microsoft. It's like, they're not letting go, you know? Yeah. They aren't winning in the hardware race. And by their own admission, but they're saying, look, we believe in this medium. We've spent a fortune on these different game companies and their intellectual property. They're never going to give them up.
Yeah.
And so they're in it, you know, like they own Call of Duty. That is the biggest brand in game.
Wild, and right? They Candy Crush, all these things. And a lot of people forget that like Windows, like Microsoft, they're just implementing what the Microsoft like ecosystem is into their gaming, which is, you know, Microsoft is everywhere. Like, you can buy a Microsoft Surface if you want to, or you can just go buy a Dell computer. You know, like, it still comes, you're still getting Windows. And like, so I don't know why people were like, oh, how dare they be putting Xbox games elsewhere? I'm like, because they want people to buy their games. Like, they're a business. Yeah. You know? Like, they want everyone to enjoy their games and everything. So,
definitely. Yeah, it'd be wild to see a battle of these trillion-dollar companies, like, taking it seriously. Yeah. You know? Because at that scale, Apple is the only company that can really compete with Microsoft and what they have done. I don't necessarily want them to go on another monopolistic spending spree, and then we just have these two, you know, category giants out there. But it would be nice to see an alternative, somebody thinking like that. Apple's still very much about the walled garden and all of that, but they make some really beautiful hardware. So. It is interesting, man. Like I still can't believe that the deck is such a success, you know, like they really pulled it off. It's a beautiful piece of machinery and it's essential, I think, you know, and the other ones are getting really good too. Like all the other handheld PCs are getting really, Rogue really Ally, freaking exciting.
MSI just came out with a new one, the Claw and everything.
Yeah, the Claw. Yep.
Yeah. It's wild times. I guess one more question before we signed off here is, are you planning on doing a Twitch marathon, like how Bob Ross is? Like Bob Ross is always on. I guess once you've done this YouTube part right here, are you planning on having like EP on 24/7 if you are able to do that?
That is something I've been wanting to do. Yes. Okay. I've been thinking about all kinds of cool things that we can do with this material. There's documentaries and all of that stuff. And it's, you know, I'm kind of at another crossroads here, Marcel, you know, like it feels like I could focus all my energy on documenting the way things used to be. And that's not a bad thing, but I am also obsessed with the new as well. Right. So I guess what I'm hoping for is maybe some more partnerships. You know, I've got an incredible partnership with PMP Games out of Winnipeg. They're the premier sponsor on this classic material. And I've got some outreach to a few other businesses, but I haven't gone whole hog because, again, I'm making new things. So I'm not like spending all my day, you know, banging a drum about what we have done. But it would be great to have a few more partners to kind of build out a team that can help me and help this kind of grow and reach more people. But I certainly have been thinking about some cool things that we can do specific to Twitch and in celebration of all of this stuff, but also as extra content attached to all of this. That's
that'd be awesome.
That'd be fun.
That'd be so cool.
You'd like that, huh?
I will absolutely love that because, like, you just tune in anytime and, like, maybe you might even become, like, a global emote on Twitch. You never know because there's Bob Ross everywhere. And everyone just, and, like, sometimes they celebrate Bob Ross. They put on the front page of Twitch sometimes. And, you know,
that's
like,
great.
It's like, once again, like, he teaches people how to paint. A lot of people, the whole art section became a thing due to that. And, like,
Ross is just running 24/7 on his own channel.
His own channel and everything. Yeah exactly.
That's so cool.
It's crazy.
That's
it's
so cool.
Crazy.
Well, we could certainly do that. We certainly have. We have the turnkey solution to build our own EP network like that. I mean, that's why we called it EPN. We were starting to build so much material that it was like it was time to brand it something a little bit larger, because I would just say the show, you know, you want to be on the show, or we're going to do this on the, but we had a bunch of shows running and documentaries and other things. Yeah, you got my brain. Yeah, I feel like I'm pretty ambitious, and now you're making me like, okay, what else can you do?
If you ever want to brainstorm, you let me know. You can call me anytime now, you know?
Oh, man, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
I certainly appreciate that idea, though. That's a wonderful, wonderful idea, and it's a nice impetus to start thinking about what's next, which is great, man. Thank you.
Absolutely. So any, I'll give you a chance here, the spotlight here. Any words you want to say for everyone who's listening?
Thank you. You know, thank you for listening to this, and thank you for watching our content for so many years. I am really looking forward to watching this material again. If you don't know the URL, it's youtube.com/EPNTV. And every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, starting March 23rd, we're going to start from episode one, season one, and from September of 1997, we're just going to run through our whole catalog of Electric Playground every week. We did 4,000 plus episodes of EP and reviews on the run, which was called Judgment Day in the U.S. Yeah. And we're going to bring all of that to you at the best resolution that we can. It's going to be a lot of fun. I hope that you guys will spend some time to come and join us and watch this material, and feel free to comment how you like. Just please remember that it was produced many years ago, and the reviews don't need to be relitigated in 2024. say whatever you want to say. I'm excited that people are going to be able to see all of this material again.
I'm super excited. I'm definitely going to be tuning in. I'll actually be in Boston tuning in, checking it out.
Wicked, man.
And definitely, once again, everyone, here's a little housekeeping. YouTube.com/EPN. TV, and a huge shout outs to PNP Games and University of Mississauga as well for making this all possible as well. And then also thank you,
absolutely,
Victor. Thank you, Victor, for absolutely just everything you have done. This was, I can honestly talk to you for hours here and everything. I don't want to keep up too much of your time, because I know you're so busy as well. But thank you so much for this opportunity. This is definitely off of my bucket list and everything. So thank you so much for this.
I can't wait to come back, Marcel.
Absolutely.
I can't wait to join some of the other people that are in your podcast circle there, man. That'll be a lot of fun.
You'll be on there for hours. You better block off some time. That'll be a fun episode. Absolutely.
Let's do it.
Absolutely.
Let's do it. Well, I'm looking forward to your feedback, and keep the great ideas coming my way. And anytime you want me back, just reach out, and I will do the same. I would like to have a little Canadian cabal, pop into Vic's basement every once in a while, and we could talk about some of the current things that are going on out there in games. Keep it positive, though.
Absolutely. We'll love that. And of course, to you, Victor, Lucas, play forever. All right.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you, everybody.
Take care.